From a secret location in room 100 of 540 Jack Gibbs Boulevard, this is Craft. I'm your host, Doug Dangler. Singer-songwriter Dar Williams has spent a career crafting tasteful melodies and incisive, intelligent lyrics on the folk and folk rock circuit. She will be appearing November 9th with 6-string concerts in Columbus, Ohio. More information about that is available at www.craftheshow.com. Welcome to Craft, Dar Williams.
Thank you.
On your new record, In the Time of Gods, you're dealing with some really heavy topics, like the opening track, I Am the One Who Will Remember Everything, which examines poverty's impact on war and religion with young people. What was your inspiration for this song?
You know, it was kind of a two worlds colliding thing where, you know, right after, believe it or not, right after 9/11, my friend who is in Arlington and who called me actually as the Pentagon was being hit by a plane, she said, you know, what I know about the Taliban, and that's what they're leaking this to, is that the Taliban are mostly the orphans of the war between Russia and Afghanistan. So right in the middle of this thing happening that was so shocking, the whole context of this thing that sort of changed a lot of people's lives and mine was seen through the lens of government that, or this, you know, these leaders who had never been parented. And it just, it hit me really deeply. And I kept on hearing about Sandra Bullock and Angelina Jolie giving lots of money to refugee camps. And I just thought, how smart of them. They know that, you must find ways to parent children even through these things.
What have we here? He must be 3 or 4. Shaking out of a boot on its way back to war. And he's not looking for a father or a mother, just a 7-year-old brother on this smudge-lined border camp of refugees. I am the one who will remember everything.
Years later, I became a parent, and it's a very gradual daily process, and sometimes it's like water torture, but, you know, you have to read these books over and over again, and, you know, every day you have to find a way to get all of those vitamins and minerals in them. Every day you have to cross the bridge to get to the school. You can't have that bridge be bombed out. You have to be around. You have to have buildings with roofs on them. And so putting together so much loss and the idea that my kids need so much eyeballing, like every day, gave birth to that song.
One other follow-up on that, in that the title of the song, I Am the One Who Will Remember Everything, I think is told from the viewpoint of the child in the story, the orphan, the war orphan. I kept reading it sometimes as, and especially in view of what you just said about being a parent, as sort of the, there's also another reading as the parent being the one who will remember, or the child becomes a parent and becomes the person who has to remember everything.
Yeah, I would say it's much more of an adult thing, and it's whether it's from empathy or sympathy or experience. When I wrote it, was actually sort of through the voice, because there was this reference back to all these really ancient stories of like a hovering, omniscient voice, like a goddess, warrior goddess saying, but of children.
Right.
So saying you cannot let these kids slip through the cracks. You know, they will be raised by religious texts instead of humans. And you need humans to interpret these texts. You need parents. And so these kids will come back in 20 years as these ideology-driven, cruel ideologues. And who wins there? Nobody. So it's kind of this voice of time, really, more than anything. And that sounds really pretentious, but it is.
Okay. You've got a line in here that I was particularly taken by. I was really surprised the first time I heard it. It says, and he will grow with pain and fear and jealousy, taken in by schools of zealotry. And I was surprised because that may be the only time I've ever heard the word zealotry used in a song. I want to compliment you.
Yeah.
On that, I thought, that's a, wow, I did not expect that sort of terminology in a folk song.
I got that from Sting. Sting always had these words, you know, and I heard some like MTV interview with him when I was in a teenager, where he said, you know, you don't know a word, go look it up. So the rock and roll school of go look it up. And there's all sorts of words that I've snuck into, like I put crypto-fascist in one of my songs. I'm very proud of that too.
Did you have to rhyme something with that?
No. It just had to phrase.
Okay.
It just had to phrase out, which is, you know, hard enough.
Yeah. What's your usual songwriting process then? You've got a thesaurus or a dictionary in one hand, a guitar in the other. What? How does that work?
Now I've got a steering wheel on one hand. It's weird. It's like a magic window. And it's probably very similar for a lot of different art projects. Anything that kind of requires a bolt from the blue. You actually just have to keep yourself open for lightning to strike. And then when it does, you just get really interested in something. And if it comes into your head as like with a little rhyme and a little melody, you say, oh, this is coming to me as a song. And so you pursue it. And the only thing I've learned to do is that it's like a fragile thread, you know, when you get something in your head that's very cool and interesting to you. And you have to sort of kind of follow it along and just sort of see what it goes and see how long that original inspiration lasts. And if possible, pull over and write things down and do as much as you can when that original, electricity comes to you. And then you have to sit yourself down and say, how does this rhyme? How does this track, it's called, you know, how does this phrase out? Is this pleasant? Is this a, you know, like, there's a song I wrote that I was going to call The Year of the Rat, and it became a song called Buzzer. And there was going to be a whole thing about this woman being in a Chinese restaurant, discovering that she was born in the Year of the Rat, and, you know, taking part in these science experiments and realizing at the end of the song that she's just this big rat. And you know, it was gross. Like, I just didn't want to put rat all over the song. So I ended up pulling, you know, sort of one of the original images of the song, because that was just, you know, who wants a rat tramping all around your lyrics? And so I pulled it, you know, and so you have to do that too. You kind of have to make it flow, and you have to sort of look at the images in your mind and see if they're unified and really, you know, present a picture, the picture you want to create and all that stuff. And that just requires time.
Mm-hmm. And that follows, I think, really naturally from you had a song a while back called the Mark Rothko song, in which you talk about imagery and painting and the painter's life, I guess.
That's true. Yeah, it was. That was the kind of thing that probably that was a fun song to write, and that was one of those things that I was. In a museum, and I saw a painting, a Mark Rothko painting, and it was called Untitled Blue Green, and I had sort of not read the title correctly, and somehow in that moment I felt so bad for the painting, and I felt so bad for Mark Rothko that I almost sort of misinterpreted what it was or what the name was. Like, I couldn't even read the title correctly before I was moving on. Mm-hmm. And so then I learned more about Mark Rothko. You know, I imagine him being like really this very quiet painter. And what I learned kind of helped the song, because it turns out he was totally gregarious. Like, he loved to talk all the time. And yet there was this other language that he was obviously trying to get to, and he committed suicide ultimately. So, you know, there was always that yearning. And I think that was probably a good training for those of us who've played, you know, in empty bars and things like that. You know, it gets pretty existential sometimes.
Well, you know, I've often wondered, at the risk of misinterpreting the ending of the song, whether what happens to the person that the other viewer, right? There's another, I think there's another person looking at the painting with you in the song, and whether that ends well for that person who says, oh, you know, he was a suicide.
Well, you know, I think that person sort of represents a flake. No, or represents, you know, a painting's worst enemy, a person who just kind of looks at it casually, doesn't have any relationship with it and moves along, which is life. But so the person's basically saying, like, yeah, this is cool. Oh, by the way, like, that guy committed suicide. Isn't that crazy? And, you know, let's go. And so the narrator is a person who says, you know, what I'm trying to learn here is that there's more to the story. We can't, you know, perhaps being dismissive is really the fatal flaw of the situation, not suicide, you know, being right. Suicidal. So that's how it ends.
Right. Yeah. I completely missed that because I'm not good. Because I was I was more concerned with the two people in it. I thought, well, somebody's going to be in bad shape after the viewing of this painting. Somebody was in bad shape. I thought the narrator and the other person. But okay, I'm glad. No, it's actually a little brighter.
It's brighter and shallower.
Well, my last question is, one of my favorite songs that you do is a really remarkable reworking of Pink Floyd's Comfortably Numb. It's a duet with Ani DiFranco. What led you to cover that song? Because it's such a beautiful and different take on that song.
You know, it's such a beautiful piece of poetry. And isn't that so cool when you listen to something and you know it for its culture and for its awesome guitar solos, you know, the movie The Wall, and you know it for its sort of sensationalism. But then you just listen to the lyrics, and that song has so much lost in it. It's amazing. I mean, you know, one layer of the song is you've got this guy, and this is certainly in The Wall, this performer, and he's become such a caricature of himself, and he's so drugged up, and it's all about performance and getting him sort of performance enhanced enough to get on the stage. And it's kind of got that bright, flashy glimmer about it. But the truth is, for any of us who have experienced this thing called getting older, you know, there's this part of the second chorus that says, "When I was a child, I caught a fleeting glimpse. Out of the corner of my eye, I turned to look, but it was gone. I cannot put my finger on it now. The child is grown, the dream is gone. I have become comfortably numb." So much deeper than, you know, oh yeah, there are these people and they perform and they get all freaked out and then they have to be, you know, shot through with bunches of drugs and ooh, isn't that terrible? Like, that's just being a human. And I felt like the whole song had all this childhood in it and mortality and that, you know, maybe a female voice and a lyric-based interpretation would bring that out.
Well, it certainly does. And it's I hope on November 9th, when you visit Columbus, Ohio, with the six-string concert series, that you will consider that as part of your repertoire.
Well, I always consider requests. That's very good.
But, well, again, Dar Williams, thank you very much for talking to me today on Craft.
Thank you. And, you know, I wanted to let you know, I opened for Ani DiFranco in 1994 at six-string concerts. So one of the reasons she was on that song, Uncomfortably Numb, is that she and I became friends in 1994 during the few concerts we were doing sort of in the Midwest. But six-string concerts was right up there. It was one of my favorites.
Great. That's why we always say the Midwest, the birthplace of all great music.
I totally agree. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about Dar Williams, visit www.craft.com. theshow.com. And while you're there, friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/craft or leave a comment for us on iTunes. Enter Craft Exploring Creativity in the search bar and it'll take you to our podcasts. Till next time, this is Doug Dangler. Be creative.